Head of German hospital commits suicide. There's no virus. It's a dictatorship disguise. This is from a website called Best News Here. I have no earthly idea if this is one to check out. But, you know, listen to what I have to say. And then if you want to go back and do some research and make sure that I'm not, you know, giving you bullshit or whatever, you know, do that. But this is, I'm just going to read you the news. That's my job. Reading you the news and commentating on the news. Let's do it. Okay. Chemnitz mourns the loss of Dr. Thomas Jenges, 55, the head of the Chemnitz Hospital, fell from the hospital building, and they have fell in quotation marks, on Flemingstrasse Tuesday morning. He died from his injuries. Well, yeah, if he survived, man, that would be pretty amazing. Be like Superman. Dr. Jenges was appointed managing director of East Germany's largest municipal hospital in April and has been the sole managing director since October the 1st. He leaves behind a wife and son. The background to the accident is still unclear. So far, however, everything points to a tragic suicide. Got tired of murdering people? Really not much is said in that article. Really not much is said there. I mean, I hate to say it, just being honest. Okay, now. Yeah, and you guys are getting articles now, so. Okay. Jen Psaki. Oh, what the hell is this from? Big League Politics. All sites I've never heard of. Jen Psaki attacks Kyle Rittenhouse and Proud Boys instead of apologizing to Kyle. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki Tuesday attacked Kyle Rittenhouse, who defended Kenosha, Wisconsin during leftist riots and was acquitted on all charges stemming from a self-defense shooting of leftist attackers, including pedophile Joseph Rosenbaum. Psaki refused to take the opportunity to apologize to Rittenhouse after Joe Biden weighed in negatively against Rittenhouse in 2020, arguably impacting the case before the jury was selected. This is about a campaign video released last year that President Trump's own... Oh, I saw this on Memeology. President Trump's own words during a debate as he refused to condemn white supremacists and militia groups, Psaki pivoted. The red-headed press flack then stated that... Then stated that the president spoke to the verdict last week. He has obviously condemned the hatred and division and violence we've seen around the country by groups like the Proud Boys and groups that the individual is posing photos with, but beyond that, I'll leave it to his comments around the verdict. The Proud Boys talking point is not new. Chuck Todd's guest, Joyce Vance, a legal expert of some kind, said on MSNBC following the verdict that Rittenhouse flashed white power signs with the Proud Boys, which is untrue. Rittenhouse was pictured making the A-OK hand sign, which is not actually a white power sign, according to many observers. Biden said in a typically bizarre rambling interview, Why don't we just say a typical rambling interview? Because that's all Biden can do. Well, you see, it's... white supremacy, racism, blah, 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 blah. I pooped my pants. Okay. Falling is colonoscopy. Thinking of pooping pants. That he stands behind the jury verdict in the case. Later, a statement was issued that was credited to Biden that used more progressive-sounding language to clarify. While the verdict in Kenosha will leave many Americans feeling angry and concerned, myself included, we must acknowledge that the jury has spoken. Okay, here's another one. I'm black. My son is white. Here's what we deal with when we leave the house. Our society has grown accustomed to seeing white parents with black kids, but black parents with white kids, not so much. There is little that brings me joy as much as the sound of my toddler's chunky legs on our parquet floors as he makes that sharp right at the foyer and heads towards his shoes. The mere mention of the word outside and the kid's ready to go. Should we go to the park or maybe that fancy outdoor mall across town? We tricycled this... We tricycled this morning, so this next outing needs to be a destination. But which one would be the least exhausting? And I don't mean the copious amounts of energy needed to take a toddler anywhere. No, no. I'm talking about the exhaustion I already feel just thinking about dealing with another episode of Black Dad, White Son. This is the point where I tell you that my husband, who is white, and I are the proud foster to adopt parents of our 21-month-old son. He came home to us shortly before Christmas 2020 when he was 9 months old. I don't know if it was Saint Nick, Father Christmas, or that Italian couple who played Mama and Papa Claus and Rudolph who made it happen, but our Christmas bundle of joy had arrived and everything was perfect. Well, somewhat perfect. Nearly perfect. Perfect adjacent. As an interracial couple, our one small caveat to us adopting was that our child be a mix of something. It just seemed like it would be much easier undertaking for all of us. I concluded that having a racially ambiguous baby would stem questions in an already questionable circumstance. So when we were presented with the whitest baby on the face of the earth, I'm talking straight up white, no chaser of ethnicity, white, 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 Alan Willis from the Jeffersons white, I was honestly like, Our society is accustomed to seeing white parents with black kids, but black parents with white kids? Not so much. So when I saw our son's little face looking back at me from his placement photo, I was just confused. I never thought we'd be presented with a little white baby. Those were usually the ones reserved for white heterosexual couples. Here I have been preparing all my life to raise the most self-assured, entitled black or some other non-white child that I could, fist pump high with pride and self-love. But looking at this blonde, blue-eyed baby, it felt like I'd been practicing for marching band regionals only to have all the other schools call out with mono on the day of the statewide competition. What had all that prep been for? Apparently, I should have been doing a different kind of training. Now, I was potentially going to be the father of a child the world would always clearly see. Goal, right? But as he looked back at me from that photo, it only took a millisecond to readjust my own vision to what a gift he was. So we said yes. Then once he was finally in my arms, the only emotion I felt was unconditional love. He was as perfect could be. I guess I could now stop pushing black hair care videos on my husband. And as charted as this territory would be, I knew that we would rear the most enlightened white kid ever. The world wouldn't know what hit him. With a new baby at home and a global pandemic raging just beyond our front door, we were in pretty much full-on nest mode, which luckily helped our bonding process. We had very little interaction with the outside world. We spent our time fixated on his schedule, tending to his dietary needs and working with on motor skills. Then came a new administration, finally a chance for people to get the vaccine. Things began opening up again, people started to venture out. Concerned that our 2020 baby would become some awkward, socially inept kid that wouldn't know a booger from a bougainvillea, we got the shots as soon as we could. So we too could do some as safe as possible for our baby venturing, and get him acquainted with a living, breathing, thriving world beyond our pottery barn, high-end loomed area rug. God damn. Okay, folks, the one thing about this fucking article is it's not an article. It's a damn fucking book. They're talking about Los Angeles, a bussing modern metropolis where people tend to be unfazed by the most outlandish things. It's Hollywood, for Christ's sakes. It invented outlandish. But even in our hip little hamlet just north of the city, where the I'm with her, Prius driving, taste all the flavors, at salt and straw, voted for Obama twice crowd reside, we have become the object of such fascination due to the unconventional makeup of our family. I mean, this is really fucking long. If you want me to go through the whole thing, I can. Let's see, like the woman who sat next to us at a cafe one day and just stared and stared and stared and stared, seemingly thinking the white dad must have had the healthier sperm. On the time not so long ago, we went to the farmer's market and unfortunately left the stroller at home. At first we felt there were just too many people to let Mr. New Legs Walking scramble around on his own. But after 30 minutes of exchanging him back and forth, we eventually put him down, which prompted him to want to hold both our hands. As we strolled linked together, competing for best in show, a woman jumped out in front of us in that unnerving Jack Ruby sort of way and asked if she could take our picture. I told her no and picked the little guy back up for the remainder of meandering through the sweet corn soaps and succulents. They're just curious, I'd tell myself, whenever something like that happened. But as these little incidents started to become the norm, I slowly began to feel more and more self-conscious. I hated that I was feeling that. Here I was, Mr. Confident with his head held high, who only walks in his truth, and now I felt like I was being a scowling figure who, from behind a KN95 mask and sunglasses, watched and felt everyone's eye on his family and silently dared them to say something. That's too much to carry around, but what can you do? Black dad, white son only intensifies when my son and I are out on our own. The looks, as I interpret them, range from I've never seen a black male nanny to did that man just take that baby? Recently, when a cashier at the grocery store asked if my son was my baby, I wanted to tell her the only question she should be asking was paper or plastic. This is the exhaustion I speak of. The response from black people seems to have more of a how could you tone. Wow, now that's a black pill. Well, more of a red pill, I guess you say. A white baby? Lord Jesus, it's too much for them. I find that black people never voice their opinions directly. They're typically conveyed through a long, hard, and interrupted gaze. Then comes the muffled, not so muffled. They didn't have any black babies to adopt? It can smart, but when you hear that from strangers, you can usually ignore it. It's when it comes from people you love that it can take on a different kind of ouch. I have friends and family members who rarely, if ever, ask, how's the little guy? Or when do we get to lay eyes on this cutie pie? He conspicuously seems to never come up. What's that old saying, you know who your friends are when you adopt a white baby? But big ups to the black meter maid in Santa Monica who made it a point to take a second from the ticket she was riding across the street to shout out, I see you, Dad. She made my heart swell that day, and I will never forget her, because in that moment all I was thinking was that I was a horrible father for having forgotten to pack the lovey. Maybe you're thinking I should do some yoga or meditation to release some of the energy I hold regarding the situation. But the true salve has been this online group of compadres I recently found. I did a search to see if there were any other black people out there with white kids, and there are. And the stories from these black transracial foster and adoptive parents are so similar to my own. From the hysterical, oh no they didn't, that it's made me feel so seen. Huh. As I got to know these parents, they became a sounding board and safe place to land. The small subset of people knew exactly what I was experiencing because they were experiencing it too. Wow, I was in a support group. This is the kind of shit white people do. But I don't care, it's great, and I love connecting with them. Finding these folks has not only helped me get it together a little better by showing me I'm not the only one dealing with this stuff, just as importantly, it's made me realize I'm not making this shit up. I can spend less time and emotional energy wondering if the things I'm hearing and feeling are real, and more time finding ways to deal with them. There's been one piece of advice from a woman in the group that's been especially useful, and I heard it to this day. She advised me to always carry our son's birth certificate with me whenever I'm out with him, because unfortunately it's just a matter of time before I'm in a situation where someone has made an inaccurate presumption about me and I'll need it. I sometimes find myself watching my son and wondering how this experience of having two gay dads, wow, that's weird, who are two different races, it will impact his life. What kind of man will he become because of it? For me, it's an exciting prospect. I mean, who among us wouldn't be proud to say a healthy dose of show tunes and Frederick Douglass made them what they are today? But above all else, my hope for him is that he will always know just how much Papa and Daddy love him, that he approaches the world with loving kindness, that he'll be curious and always speak his mind, yet never feels the need to white mansplain, that he prizes knowledge and intellect, exhibits good amounts of sarcasm, cherishes joy and laughter, and most importantly, that he always has rhythm and knows how to season his food. As for me, I'm an overachieving, militant black gay Virgo. The 1,500 square feet in my head that I call my home will always be just what it is. As much as I don't always want to think about race, I will. I'm black. But I hope that with time, I will acquire more balanced equilibrium regarding black dad, white son, and maybe, just maybe, I'll become less exhausting. Maybe not. Either way, I just ask that you put your cameras down, rein in some of that annoyance or entitled curiosity, and just smile as you pass by. And who knows, maybe I will sign up for yoga or meditation. Or is that too white? This man is Scott Brown, lives in Studio City, California with his husband and son. He's a screenwriter with a penchant for world travel, classic cinema, and Little Debbie snack cakes. Well, I don't know what to say about that, folks. Honestly, don't know what to say about that one. That's a weird one, guys. That's, I don't know. I mean, it's California, so they're gonna do their own thing. Like, that's just how California fucking is. They're gonna be all progressive. Oh, two black gay dad and Yeah, I mean, there's not really much I can do. I will say that the way that black people fucking act about it, like other black people, is pretty stupid. Like, oh, I mean, like, oh, you have a black son. Oh, you have a black. You have no. You have a white son. You have a white son, but you're black. Where's the black? You're like, yeah, that's pretty fucking crazy. They try to say there's no like prejudice in the community. No, it's there's no such thing as racism. And no, okay, that's. I'm sorry, but there definitely is that kind of thing. Okay. Question on everybody's mind right now, answered by Fox. CBS News reporter pleads with Biden at White House. When will you take our questions? President Biden left the White House podium again Tuesday without taking questions. A familiar scene for frustrated reporters, except this time they let him know how they feel. Biden spoke on the economy and delivered a Thanksgiving message before telling the press he had to leave to help out at a soup kitchen. Oh yeah, sure. Sure. I want you to know how grateful I am to serve as your president, he said. And I promise you that I'll never stop working to address your family's needs. And together we're going to have to face challenges. We're going to face them honestly, and that we'll keep building this economy around hardworking folks who built this country. Happy Thanksgiving, and may God bless you, and may God protect our troops. All right. I want to know what soup kitchen Biden was at. Y'all, go look that up. Show me some pictures of Biden helping out in a fucking soup kitchen. President of the United States, I'm gonna take off all my duties as president to help out in a soup kitchen. I ain't fucking buying it, folks. I don't believe it. But the reporters in the room didn't sound so grateful. Several journalists shouted questions at Biden and tried to get him to turn around, and one reporter's voice stood out. When will you answer questions about your meeting with Xi Jinping and other leaders? CBS News radio correspondent Stephen Portnoy pleaded as Biden walked out of the room. When will you answer our questions, sir? Never! Ha ha Saki, give them bullshit as usual. Right away, sir. See, well, we have a roundabout way of saying things that. You know, we don't want to get to the point. It's just about beating around the bush and saying not giving non-answers all the time. Isn't the weather nice today? But what about the meeting with Xi Jinping? Oh, China. Yeah, well, we definitely support the Chinese ban on gaming more than 3 hours. That's really good. We support that. China's a great place if you haven't visited it. But I want to know about Xi Jinping! Oh, speaking of China, have you seen Shang-Chi? That's a good movie. It has a lot of cultural, not so much cultural appropriation, but it represents the spirit of China very well. That's not what I want to know! It's been a week since Biden's summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping, but the former has yet to remark on what was discussed in their meetings, Portnoy noted in a follow-up on Twitter. The specific question is, when will you tell us what you discussed with Xi Jinping and other leaders? When will you answer our question, sir? It's been over a week since the Xi summit, and Americans still haven't heard from their president about what he discussed. Wow! That's telling you something, folks. He hasn't said a damn thing about it. Yeah, we're ready. You know, whenever you're ready to take over America, Jinping, President Xi, we're there. We'll be waiting. You can bring all your Chinese in, you know, just get rid of most of. We know the economy will be better under China anyway. We're fully committed to adopting the yuan. So just go ahead, you know. America had its time, but we're fine with becoming part of China. Just we'll start teaching the kids Mandarin already. Just Throw it right on them. They already learning Spanish. You'll just throw Mandarin in. No big deal. Start putting a little bit more Mandarin on our products, and we'll be a full annex of China before 2040. White House Secretary Jen Psaki did field questions on their meeting last Thursday, surprising some by not denying whether or not Biden requested assistance from President Xi to track down the origins of COVID-19. I would say the president's push for the Chinese to participate more and more transparent, to participate more and provide more transparent data and information. We've never held back on that front, Psaki said. We've argued for it publicly. We've argued for it at every level. And the president did talk in his meeting the importance of transparency, which this is exactly an example of. Biden has previously avoided taking questions after press conferences on the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, poor job reports, the rise in inflation, and the Democrats' reconciliation bill and what it will mean for the U.S. economy. Instead of staying for questions on the multi-trillion dollar package last month, Biden told reporters, I'll see you in Rome before jetting off for summits in Europe. All right. Let me see if anybody's listening. Nope, it's just me. That's fine. Phrase trigger warning is too triggering for students, university says. Worried that emotionally fragile students might not be able to handle it, Warwick University has scrapped the use of the term trigger warning to alert students to the presence of provocative material in assignments. The phrase trigger warning itself has become a provocative term, the university confirmed to the Daily Mail on Sunday, announcing that it had relegated the phrase to the dustbin of university history and replaced it with content notes. Such notes varied in content, but were generally described as being necessary because trigger is too provocative a word to deploy on a daily basis. The decision to pull the trigger on trigger warnings didn't go well with everyone. Tory MP Andrew Bridgen insisted the university's move to take offense at the word was ludicrous. He also argued content warnings in general were getting out of control and harming the next generation, and wondered who was behind demands for students to tie themselves to such linguistic pretzels. The university's reading material is widely marked up with content notes, according to the Daily Mail, with such notices advising that plays, poems and books like Homer's The Odyssey and, somewhat ironically, George Orwell's 1984 are not comfortable reading, but important reading. Shakespearean tragedy, students also warn, may be riddled with representations of violence and the suffering caused by violent acts. One content note, reproduced by the Mail, suggests an entire library canon might as well be the subject to one big trigger warning, pointing out that studying literature necessarily involves confronting particular ideas, words, and experiences that you might find offensive, upsetting, or disturbing. All of the modules you take in the department will involve material that can be difficult for some people, even traumatic. After submitting a Freedom of Information Act request, the Mail was told that Warwick's English and Comparative Literary Studies department helps students deal with difficult and complex questions. The spokesperson admitted that the way the school dealt with such strategies had recently changed, but did not elaborate further. Wow, trigger warning is too much. Okay, and here is the $1.25 tree. Dollar Tree hikes prices 25%. Most items will cost $1.25. The company, one of America's last remaining true dollar stores, said Tuesday it will raise prices from $1 to $1.25 on the majority of its products by the first quarter of 2022. The change is a sign of the pressures low-cost retailers face holding down prices during a period of rising inflation. Dollar Tree said in a quarterly earnings release that Tuesday that its decision to raise prices to $1.25 permanently, however, was not a reaction to short-term or transitory market conditions. Dollar Tree also said that hiking prices will help the company increase its profit margins by mitigating historically high merchandise cost increases, including freight and distribution costs, as well as wage increases. This is the appropriate time to shift away from the constraints of the dollar price point, CEO Michael Witnitsky said in a statement. Dollar Tree carries primarily seasonal goods, toy stationery, home decor, kitchenware, and party items. It caters to suburban middle-income shoppers, unlike Dollar General, its more rural-focused rival. Family Dollar, owned by Dollar Tree, I didn't know that, targets mostly low-income shoppers in cities. Dollar Tree has sold products at $1 for 35 years and was the last of the major dollar store chains to actually be a dollar store. The company was called Only a Dollar in the late part of 20th century before changing its name to Dollar Tree in 1993. Dollar Tree had started moving away from only offering goods to a dollar in recent years in part of response to pressure on Wall Street to raise prices. I didn't know that. Dollar Tree has lagged Dollar General and other discount chains. In 2019, an activist investor... Hold on. In 2019, an activist investor took a stake in the company and pressed the chain to raise prices. The group ended its fight after Dollar Tree announced it planned to test different prices. In September, Dollar Tree said it began selling items at $1.25 and $1.50 at some stores for the first time. It also said it would add $3 and $5 items to more stores, expanding on a prior strategy to offer these prices at select locations. Since the announcement, a different activist investor built a stake in Dollar Tree and has tapped a former Dollar General CEO to push for changes at the company. Although Dollar Tree has said its decision to permanently raise prices was not a reaction to short-term inflation, one analysis was unconvinced. At the pace of rollout, along with the engaged investor, Mantle Ridge, clearly suggests otherwise, Kelly Banya, an analyst at BMO Capital Markets, said in a note to clients Tuesday. Okay. Cowboy Bebop's Mason Alexander Park on Gren's new journey in righting the wrongs of the anime. Rainbow Crew is an ongoing interview series that celebrates the best LGBTQ representation on the screen. Each installment, man, I can't even spell that right, showcases talent working on both sides of the camera, including queer creatives and allies to the community. Next, we're speaking to Cowboy Bebop star Mason Alexander Park. Mason Alexander Park has spent their whole career hoping to exist as a queer person within a sci-fi world, and now they're about to appear in two. Just recently, the non-binary star was cast in Desire. Oh, cast as Desire. Now, well, God, I love The Sandman, but I don't know about this adaptation. I've wanted it all my life, but I don't know if I want this one. Cast as Desire, one of the Endless, in Netflix's adaptation of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman. I am giving The Sandman a chance, though, because I'm such a fucking fan of all of it. And, to have it destroyed in front of me, you know... It is what it is. I'll accept that loss, that beating, that punishment, I guess. I don't know. For being a fan of the franchise. But before that, Mason has just made their debut as Gren in another Netflix adaptation, Cowboy Bebop. Despite the overall love fans feel for the original Cowboy Bebop anime, Gren has always proved to be a divisive character. On the one hand, it was incredibly progressive to see a 90s character describe himself as both man and woman, but also neither. However, certain trans tropes were also entwined within Gren's arc, making them a pivotal yet still somewhat problematic icon for queer fans watching back at home. Thankfully, Netflix's new take on Cowboy Bebop has taken an opportunity to overhaul Gren's backstory and portray them fully as a non-binary character who is played by a non-binary actor. It felt really affirming, Mason tells us when we ask about their initial casting. I think it's rare for people to get it right when it comes to casting queer identities to play and tell a great story. So to have such an iconic queer-coded role... God, I hate these fucking coded words... Queer-coded role to be reclaimed by an openly queer person that hits the gender confusion outside the story was really exciting for me. I actually debated with somebody on Twitter over the word autistic-coded, because they were claiming that Ed was autistic-coded. That doesn't mean that the person is autistic. It means that they were apparently coded by the creators to be an autistic person. Like they try to say that Piccolo is black-coded. From Dragon Ball Z, he's coded to be a black character. Yeah, this is weird. This is their interpretations on shit. I had a bunch of people supporting me. I'm like, look, I'm autistic. That's kind of offensive to say that somebody is autistic coded. Like, that's just a fucking hyperactive person. Doesn't mean they're fucking autistic. They're like, I don't know. It's fucking stupid. And a lot of people got my back on that on Twitter. But yeah, this is a full interview, man, so I'm not gonna read it. I mean, it's long as fuck. But there you go. So they said they righted the wrongs of the anime. They fixed what was wrong with Japan. Japan's gonna get pissed. Japan's gonna get pissed, and they're not gonna want to bring anything over. If Netflix keeps on fucking up their property, Japan's gonna go full xenophobic. Like they already are, you know. Usually, we can't get their games because they're fucking xenophobic. I was talking about it in a Eroge forum. Some of the guys in there, they're like, yeah, they're xenophobic, and I'm like, well, there's not much you can fucking do about it. I'm sorry, there's not a whole lot you can do about it. Just play Kamidori Alchemy Master, and that's all you get. That's all we ever fucking translated because the fan translated it. You know, they should translate more of it, honestly, just to spite them, you know, because they want to be like that. It's like, yeah, you know what? It's fine. We'll translate more of your stuff. We'll translate the other games. Like, they don't give a shit. Like, honestly, they weren't going to give them to us anyway. Everything else gets a machine translation, but you don't get the story or the script. Inside a DC jail's Patriot Wing, where Capitol Riot defendants sing the national anthem and act like prisoners of war, but struggle to cope with being locked up. Around 40 Capitol Riot defendants facing serious charges are held together in a DC jail. They call it the Patriot Ring. The Patriot Wing. Wow, the group has formed a strong bond, even developing nightly rituals. Every night at 9 p.m., they stop what they're doing to sing the Star Spangled Banner. Some of them are in their cells, and some of them are out in the common area, but whatever it is they're doing, they stop and they sing, Cynthia Hughes told Insider. Hughes' nephew is one of the roughly 40 Capitol Riot defendants held without bail in connection with the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Hughes requested that Insider not name her nephew. The group is being housed in a separate section of the sprawling central detention facility in southeast Washington, D.C., located just a few miles away from the building that they were accused of storming. To most people, that section is called the Correctional Treatment Facility, but to many defendants, their supporters, and even some Republican lawmakers, it's the Patriot Wing. It houses the defendants facing the most serious accusations in relation to the insurrection. Some of the residents, including Enrique Tarrio, are tied to organized extremist groups like the Proud Boys and Three Percenters. Many are accused of assaulting police officers and carrying weapons on Capitol grounds, as residents have included Jacob Chansley, the QAnon shaman, who was sentenced to 41 months in prison this week, Kyle Fitzsimmons, who was photographed wearing butcher's workwear at the Capitol, and Timothy Hale Cusinelli, a U.S. Army reservist who prosecutors said sported a Hitler mustache to work. As the defendants await their trials together, they appear to have formed a tight-knit group, creating nightly rituals and organizing group activities. Insider reviewed multiple legal filings and spoke to sources familiar with the jail conditions for the story. The Washington, D.C. Department of Corrections did not respond to Insider's multiple requests for comment. In October the 26th, a court hearing, the attorney Stephen Brenwald recounted the moment he heard the defendants sing their nightly rendition of the national anthem while on the phone with his client, Thomas Sibick. Sibick is charged with several counts, including robbery and assaulting a police officer, per count documents seen by Insider. I heard them myself, Brenwald said, Law and Crime reported. It was literally this herd mentality. They're literally singing most of them off-key. It's literally singing the song, almost cult-like. It was pretty scary, actually. But Hughes, who said she speaks to her nephew daily, said the singing is what gets them through. Greg Hunter, an attorney for the other defendants at jail, Jeff McKillop, and Kyle Fitzsimmons told Insider the singing was an homage to the Hanoi Hilton prison in North Vietnam, which held American prisoners of war during the Vietnam War. The late Senator John McCain, who was held there, recalled in 2013 a cellmate standing up to the Vietnamese guards by singing the Star Spangled Banner. To witness him sing the national anthem in response to having a rifle pointed at his face, well, that was something to behold. For many of the Capitol defendants, described by some GOP politicians as political prisoners, singing the national anthem is a similar act of defiance, Hunter said. The defendants are each assigned a one-man cell. The defendants are each assigned a one-man cell, but they get to mingle in communal areas, you said. To stay occupied, they also organize events, mostly recently arranging a Halloween DIY craft contest, she said. They even have their own newsletter. Richard Barnett, who left the jail in April, told News 4 Washington, "We would all contribute to it and pass it cell to cell," he said. Patriot support groups and fan mail. The defendants... Hold on. Yeah, I'm making sure this is long as fuck. The defendants are being propped up by a sprawling public support network who send donations, greeting cards, and gifts on a weekly basis, Hughes said. A loyal fan base is also congregating in several Telegram channels seen by Insider. The supporters on one channel called the Patriot Mail Project share recordings of daily prayers for the defendants. According to the channel, one of the defendants, Kyle Fitzsimmons, thanked the group for a gift, saying, "I've been receiving mail from the Patriot Mail Project. It's nice to hear from strangers." Earlier this month, they got a visit from GOP Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who tweeted this photo from jail. Several of the defendants have complained about the conditions in the wing. Some raised concerns to their lawyers, citing threats from the guards and standing sewage. Others claimed they were denied the right to conduct religious services, according to court papers seen by Insider. Defenders have also complained about the food. In February, a lawyer for Chansley, the QAnon shaman, told a court that his client had lost 20 pounds in jail because he couldn't eat any food that wasn't organic. Wow! A judge subsequently granted a request to serve him organic food in the facility. Hughes said her nephew told her the food was not nutritious enough, saying meals usually consist of cheese or bologna sandwiches, hard-boiled eggs, and crackers. In an email sent to Insider, the attorney Joseph McBride, who represents two defendants in the wing, Ryan Nichols and Christopher Quaglin, called the conditions of confinement reprehensible, unconstitutional, and a clear violation of human rights. One complaint taken seriously last month was from the Proud Boy member, Christopher Worrell, whose attorney accused jail officials of deliberately withholding urgent medical treatment after Worrell was left with a broken wrist for 4 months. Worrell was eventually released on home detention, but his case prompted the U.S. Marshals Service to initiate a surprise investigation into the jail. It uncovered serious problems in an older part of the jail complex, but not the wing where the January 6th defendants were held. Greg Urey, a vice president of the Anti-Defamation League who worked for the FBI for 22 years, told Insider that out of all the facilities he's been to, he would describe the D.C. jail as an average American facility. "I've been to better facilities, but I've also been to worse," he said. Michael Jensen, who works at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, told Insider, "We can't forget that many of the defendants who are on the wing would have never been to prison before. So they're not going to be happy with the situation. It's not a club mat. It's not a five-star hotel. It's not supposed to be. It's jail." Hughes, meanwhile, worries about how the defendants' lives will look after the trials. "I mean, how do you go back to the person you were before January 6th, she said. "That's why I don't think they should have jail at all. All right, we got State Board drops sex offender, calling it a negative label. Okay, in Denver, the way sex offenders are labeled is changing in Colorado. The board that states sex offenders are state standard. The board that sets state standards voted today to change the term sex offenders to reflect so-called person first language. The Sex Offender Management Board, which is made up of everyone from public defenders to prosecutors, sets standards and guidelines for treatment providers so the new terminology will only be used in that context. It doesn't change the term sex offender in the law or criminal justice system, but some worry it's a step in that direction. "I'm involved today after hearing that it would be improper or offensive in some manner for me to refer to a man who raped me as a sex offender." A rape survivor. Kimberly Corbin is among those who spoke out against changing the term sex offender to something less stigmatizing. Saying labels based on traits people can't control is one thing. It's very, very damaging for those who are labeled. I'm not kidding. That's how it's written. "When it has to do with gender, race, sexuality, ability, but those who are not their choices." Oh! For those who people who are labeled, when it has not to do with, okay, but those who are not their choices. "The biggest thing for me is these are choices that sex offenders make. Derek Logue says he shouldn't have to carry the label for life. Referring me to a label by something I did half my life ago is inappropriate and downright offensive. He argued client would be a better term. Public defender Kathy Hethron agreed. It takes into consideration the uniqueness of individuals who are receiving treatment. Client is one of five options the board considered. Supports of the change in terminology argue it would reduce recidivism. Opponents say it will only reduce accountability, noting victims and survivors live with the label for life. In the end, the board violated 10-6 to go with adults who commit sexual offenses. I think this strikes as a balance that honors the impact of the victims and recognizes the current and ongoing impacts of sexual assault, but also avoids the labeling term that has negative impacts on those who commit sex offenses. Jessica Dotter with the Colorado District Attorney's Council warns that the change won't end with the Sex Offender Management Board. I'm concerned that the use of the person-first language generally is an attempt to remove accountability from offenders and to diminish the experience of the victims. Last year, lawmakers considered a bill that would have, among other things, eliminated the term sexually violent predator from statuses, but they ended up pulling it. Meanwhile, a task force charged with sentencing reform is considering asking the legislature to change terms like defendant, convict, and felon to justice-involved people. Ironically, the Sex Offender Management Board will not drop sex offender from its name because only the state legislature can change the name on the board. Well, I mean, there's one thing I do have to say about this. You know, sex offender, like, if you hire an escort and you get caught, you can be considered a sex offender. You know, I mean, the person can be of age, it can be consent, but you're still a sex offender. And they would say, oh, well, you raped that. I mean, so they're pretty much saying that you raped the person or you're as bad as a child molester or anything like that. Even somebody that has, like, I don't know, like, people that are into lolicon, which I don't like at all. But people that have that shit, like, they can go, oh, you're a sex offender. You've committed a, like, oh, wow, who did you rape? I had anime porn. I had cartoon anime porn. And then why do they call you that? Because there's no other fucking term. They can't call you, like, an anime porn haver or whatever. I don't know. I think it's really puritanical, and it is a problem with our country in general and the West in general. Because, you know, this stuff isn't going away as far as, you know, there's going to continue to be hentai and stuff like that. And people like the lolly shit. I don't know why they do. And then you got Opie Lollies, which is in, like, Dragon Maid, which I think got translated, localized in English. So if that Opie Lolly character is in any way sexualized, then by that standard, then everybody that watches that episode of Dragon Maid is a sex offender. Like, anybody that watches that season of Dragon Maid is a sex offender because that's an Opie Lolly character. I don't know. It's pretty crazy. Like, it's a problem. And that kind of needs to be fixed. Also, the more important thing, you know, anime not involved, is when you have a woman that you have sex with consensually, and she says that you raped her, even if you didn't and it was consensual. Because, you know, a lot of people aren't going to challenge that. And you can probably use, I mean, you can't use a rape kit because, like, I mean, you had consensual sex. And she could just say that you raped her. And then you're a sex offender because you raped this woman even though you didn't. You both consented to it. And now you're a sex offender and you can't get around kids because they think that you're, like, a child molester. And that's fucking ridiculous. That needs to change. And then you have the fact that maybe you didn't do anything with a girl. And she reports you as a sex offender anyway. And then you're in trouble for that. And you're like, oh, you... And then they put you in the same category with somebody that abused children. And you didn't have nothing to do with anything. You didn't even do anything to the person. You never touched the woman. Like, you can use a rape kit for that, and hopefully they let you do that. But there's a lot of bullshit that needs to be fixed in this country regarding that whole sex offender label. It does need to be changed. It absolutely does need to be changed. But not for everybody. Some people legitimately are. Like, you know what I'd like it to be? Like, I don't know. I mean, see, person, like, they need to talk about what the offense was. I mean, seriously, they need to talk about what the offense was, you know? I mean, it's really crazy. Yeah, I mean, if you literally abuse somebody, they need to just put child molester. They need to put like abuser, like sexual abuser. Like they need to just be real with it. Like I said, yeah, you say that you sexually abused somebody like I don't know, 10 years ago. That's still abuse, man. That's still fucking bad. But somebody that just, oh, I hired an escort, or I had sex with this woman and she said it wasn't consensual and that was it, then yeah, that needs to be stated too. Like, yeah, that's the thing. I also think women should be charged for that shit. Like if they do false rape accusations, that shit should they should be charged for it. They should get charges for that. They should get some kind of label. Like a false rape accuser or something. I don't know what you call it. Anyway, that's all I gotta say on this one, and thank you guys for joining us, and this will be the Grimlord, and I am out of here. Later.